Okay, it's time now for a bedtime story. So let's curl up and get out the iPad. Children's book apps are big sellers for the iPad. They include not only text, but also audio and games. And for tech writer and dad, Omar Gayaga, the apps are transforming bedtime.
What are you going to read?
Let me see what we have.
Scoot over.
It's bedtime for my 3-year-old daughter, Lily. She climbs into her little twin-sized bed with Tinkerbell sheets covered with dolls and stuffed animals. We're about to choose tonight's bedtime stories as she gets settled in.
All right, do you want regular books tonight or iPad?
iPad.
In November, I started reviewing children's iPad apps for Kirkus Reviews. Lily is my review partner. We've gone through 50 apps in 2 months. Like much of the Apple App Store, the quality of what's available runs the gamut from crude cash-ins with ugly illustrations, barely worth a 99-cent price tag, to lavish productions with top-notch voice talent and 3D pages. The priciest can cost up to $10.
What's that one?
Alice in Wonderland.
What's that?
Teddy.
What's this one?
Falcon and Beanstalk.
Lily doesn't know how to use the internet or a computer mouse, but she can easily navigate the iPad's touchscreen. Her small hands flip past pages of apps and she taps a finger on the ones she wants.
Once upon a time, there was a man and a woman.
Lily's in her princess phase and is obsessed with not one, but two apps that tell the tale of Rapunzel. The first is a straightforward storybook with narration, colorful, hand-drawn illustrations, and numerous hidden sound effects and animations that you can activate by pressing parts of the screen.
The kitty goes meow.
Yeah.
And then the duck goes ah.
The second is a pop-up book that asks the reader to complete small challenges before Rapunzel can meet and fall in love with her prince.
Shake the trees by tapping them to collect some apples.
She's not as crazy about some of the apps I've given high marks to, like Pop Out, The Tale of Peter Rabbit, where the characters don't just appear, they giggle and wiggle on virtual springs. Lily pokes them to make them speak, or slides what look like tabs in a paper pop-up book to make Peter squeeze under a fence or to make Mr. McGregor chase the rabbit with a rake.
Once upon a time, there was a young boy named Jack.
The apps we both love tend to build upon traditional works to create something even better, like Ayer's Animation's Jack and the Beanstalk, a great app that features voice acting, hidden sound effects, and original music. Cows moo, the golden harp plays a song, and the giant will sway on the beanstalk if Lily tilts the iPad back and forth. Do it too much, and the giant tells her, "Will you stop that already?"
Hey, you look! Stop shaking my work!
Some say that electronic books are creating a more passive reading experience. But Lily frequently reads along with the narration, pokes at the iPad screen to interact with the stories, and asks me to help her solve puzzles. When we read traditional paper books, whether it's Goodnight Moon or Mercer Mayer's Little Critters series, she's more apt to just lie down and listen.
Happily ever after.
By the time we're done, we've read 5 stories and stayed up long past Lily's bedtime.
Did we read 5 books tonight?
Yes.
We read a lot of books, huh?
Yeah.
Heads and kisses?
Omar Gayaga is the tech culture reporter for the Austin American Statesman. And on that story, he got some special help from his well-read 3-year-old daughter, Lily. You can read Omar's reviews of some of the iPad children's book apps at npr.org.
Support for All Tech Considered comes from Carbonite, providing automatic online backup with anytime, anywhere access for individuals and small businesses. Details at carbonite.com.
This is NPR News.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montaigne.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Good morning. President Obama's administration objected when Egypt shut down the internet for several days. It was part of the government's effort to slow down protests. And in this case, the U.S. supported internet freedom. The United States does not support that freedom in every case, as NPR's Tom Gelton reports.
When President Obama on Tuesday night gave his view of what should happen in Egypt, he reminded authorities there that the United States stands for universal values,
including the rights of the Egyptian people to freedom of assembly, freedom of speech, and the freedom to access information.
That last one, the freedom to access information, was a clear rebuke to the authorities in Egypt for shutting down the internet. Within 12 hours, it was up and running again. Egyptian democracy activists nevertheless complained the Obama administration moved too slowly. If so, that could be because pushing too hard in Egypt on one goal could set back progress somewhere else. Promoting internet freedom, for example, might have been seen as competing with the goal of fighting terrorism. And that's an area where the U.S. relies on Egypt, according to Richard Clark, a counterterrorism advisor to Presidents Clinton and Bush.
The Egyptian role in counterterrorism has been essential to us for the last 15 to 20 years. They've been one of the best allies we've had in the fight against al-Qaeda and other radical groups.
Here's another example where the U.S. didn't exactly embrace internet freedom, WikiLeaks. The State Department forbid employees from looking at websites that linked to secret WikiLeaks files. Clay Shirky, a new media expert at New York University, sees some possible U.S. hypocrisy here on the internet freedom issue.
The government has held itself up for criticism around things like attempts to remove WikiLeaks from its servers or variable support for the uprisings between Tunisia and Egypt.
Bottom line, internet activism is great in Tunisia, maybe less convenient where WikiLeaks is concerned or where counterterrorism is a higher priority. Here's another goal that may conflict with the promotion of internet freedom, cybersecurity. Imagine some country attacking the United States via the internet. Should the U.S. government then be able to defend itself by putting some limits on the internet? That's under debate right now in the U.S. Congress.
Computer systems of Congress and the executive branch agencies are under cyber attack an average of 1.8 billion times per month.
Republican Senator Susan Collins of Maine is a co-sponsor of legislation that would authorize the president to declare a cyber emergency if another country wages cyber war against the U.S. It would not allow him to shut down the internet like the Mubarak government did, but in exceptional circumstances, it could permit some limits on internet traffic.
The president could only restrict a particular part of a critical infrastructure if no other action could protect that system or asset.
The power grid, for example. Now, that's an understandable argument for some internet limitations. But Clay Shirky poses this question. Might not Hosni Mubarak have argued that his government was facing a cyber emergency of sorts? A political one, maybe, but still a cyber emergency.
If the judgment is we need to protect the state against things that are happening using the internet, then Mubarak's government was precisely correct in saying this is a cyber emergency, because if people are using these tools to do anything from resyndicating Al Jazeera videos to coordinating when to turn out and Tahrir Square, that is, from the point of view of the Mubarak government, exactly an emergency.
The world is a complex place. U.S. policy goals have to address many concerns. Difficult choices may need to be made, like in Egypt. The Obama administration may learn whether a new government there, one that more vigorously supports internet freedom and other democratic values, could be as strong a counterterrorism ally as the Mubarak regime has been. Tom Gelton, NPR News, Washington.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
I'm Melissa Block, and it's time now for All Tech Considered. It's been called the iPocalypse. Some headlines have been equally ominous. Internet officially runs out of addresses. The end of the internet as we know it. The web's well goes dry. To decipher those headlines, we've called on Stephen Shankland, a senior writer for CNET News. He joins us by Skype from his home outside London. Welcome, Stephen.
Thank you.
Now, we're talking about these IP addresses that have run out. Why don't you remind us, first of all, what an IP address is and what it does?
An IP address, it stands for Internet Protocol Address, and every computer or any other kind of device that attaches to the internet needs one. It's the address that you use to send email to somebody else. Each little packet of information gets labeled with that address. So when you run out, then you have trouble, because then you can't connect new devices to the internet. That might be your smartphone or your PC at home.
And we've reached that point now. Even though there were billions of IP addresses, we have now run out?
Yeah, with the current technology called IPv4, that's version 4, the central authorities only had 4.3 billion IPv4 addresses to hand out in the first place, and they just handed out the last ones. Now, we haven't actually run out for the level for most folks. Basically, what happened is it stopped raining and snowing in the mountains. But we're downstream, down the river, and we still have plenty of water right now. But, you know, at some point in the next year or two, the dry spell is going to come downstream and we're going to have a drought down where the regular folks are.
But here to help is IPv6, correct?
That's right. IPv6 has quite a lot more internet addresses. Specifically, it has 340 trillion, trillion, trillion.
Yeah, that is an amazing number. The number is 340 undecillion is the name. 340 with 36 zeros after it. You figure that's enough to last for a while?
It's enough to last for a very long time, yes. The hard part is not counting that high, though. It's actually making the transition to that technology.
Yeah, well, what's involved in that transition?
For most people, it's not really going to be that big a deal. But if you have a website, it's going to be something you're going to have to deal with. And if you're an internet service provider, you're going to have to deal with it. So this is something that the IT people out there who run computers and computer systems, it's mostly their problem to deal with. And they're going to be spending a lot of money over the next few years to make the transition to IPv6.
And as they spend money to make the transition, does that get passed on to consumers, to businesses too?
Yes, as always, with new technology, there's lots of exciting stuff that comes down the pike. But sooner or later, somebody pays for it. Hopefully, if, you know, big profitable companies are doing the transition, they can absorb the cost. But, you know, sooner or later, if your ISP has to spend a lot of money upgrading a whole lot of servers and other internet equipment, then, yeah, that cost will get passed along down to the customer.
So the transition from IPv4 to IPv6, are you anticipating that that will be pretty smooth, or are there lots of potential complications there?
I think it's going to be more in the area of hiccups and some unpleasantness than catastrophe. That's why I think the word apocalypse is a bit overblown. A lot of money is going to have to be spent, but I don't think the internet is going to come to a screeching halt, for example. Websites will get slow in some cases because when you're trying to get data from some server on the other side of the internet, the data might have to get translated from IPv4 to IPv6 and then back to IPv4. That has to happen every time a little packet of information goes from one place to another. So I think we'll see some delays in the performance of the internet as we make this gradual transition from IPv4 to IPv6.
Okay, Stephen Shankland, a senior writer for CNET News. Stephen, thanks very much.
Yeah, glad to help.
Social networking sites have become a big place for people to play games, and where there are eyeballs, there are going to be advertisers. Social games are the ones you play with your friends on sites like Facebook, and they're a hot new marketing target. But companies are not necessarily posting traditional banner ads. They actually embed the ads within the games. As NPR's Shireen Meraji reports, you'll be seeing a lot more of them.
If you recognize that tune, you are one of the 97 million Facebook users who play Cityville. It's free to play. You start with an empty plot of land and build a city on it. You invite your Facebook friends to join in the fun and soon find yourself spending time collecting rent, building businesses, growing and harvesting crops.
I am not a player of social games, I have to say. I don't really have any extra time to plant virtual crops or race around Card Town.
That is unless you're busy analyzing the business of social games, which is what Paul Verna does for eMarketer. Verna says social game publishers take in most of their revenue from the sale of virtual goods. Gamers spend real money on virtual crops, fish food, you name it. And between last year and 2012, he adds, in-game ad revenue will more than double.
The types of companies that have advertised in social games run the gamut from fast food and premium packaged food, soft drinks, pet food, apparel, packaged goods, retail, financial services.
Alex Rampell, the CEO of TrialPay, says that list goes on and on because the social game world is so diverse. TrialPay matches advertisers with social game companies. There's Cityville, Farmville, Texas Hold'em Poker, Pet Society, Mafia Wars, Cartown. Rampell says basically anything you want to advertise will work with the theme of a social game that's out there.
Most people can't stand advertising. They want to skip it. Social gaming, by providing more crops or more fish or more virtual poker chips for the poker game, it actually encourages people to interact with advertisers, and they do take notice.
So I'm just going to show you what Farmville looks like by clicking on this button, and we will be transported magically to my farm.
I'm in Mark Zeitlin's office at the Farmers Insurance headquarters in Los Angeles. Farmers is the number 3 home and auto insurance company in the U.S. It's been around since 1928.
Right. Well, we've got what I would call a kick-ass farm. I've got a couple of fields full of crops right now.
Zeitlin is the vice president of e-business, a department that's about 2 years old. He never played Farmville before deciding it could be a great marketing tool for a very unhip insurance company. Now he's addicted.
And it is hard on a marriage and other relationships, but I was very happy to begin playing it because of the excitement around putting the farmer's airship into the game.
On the upper left of Zeitlin's computer screen is a cartoon version of a Zeppelin airship with the Farmers Insurance logo on it. He negotiated a deal with Zynga, the company that created Farmville, to make the virtual airship available in the game, free, for 10 days. And if you downloaded the Farmers Airship, you got a brief respite from virtual farming.
So we had one story from a grandmother, which I'm not quite sure if it's a happy or a sad story, but she felt really relieved that she had the airship protecting her crops from withering because she was able to spend more time with her grandchildren.
Zeitlin says over 5 million users, like that grandma, downloaded the airship. And in that time, the Farmers Insurance Facebook fan page went from a handful of fans to over 120,000. Real corporate money well spent in the virtual business world. Shireen Meraji, NPR News.
The government uses .gov for its website. Schools use .edu. Now, .jobs is the place you go to find work, and it's a place where you'll find 89,000 employers. NPR's Nathan Rott reports.
Let's say you want a nursing job in Detroit. There's a new way to find it, online using a growing network of websites, all operating under an umbrella named universe.jobs. At a press conference in Washington Monday, Bill Warren of universe.jobs explains.
Right from the browser, a job seeker can put in Detroit.jobs or
nursing.jobs. For either, you'd get a list. One with nursing openings nationwide, the other with a list of Detroit jobs. Warren says you're better off combining the two, using something like DetroitNursing.jobs. That'll give you a more streamlined list of openings. By clicking on one, you'll be redirected to that employer's website where you can fill out an application. It's easy, and more importantly, it's free, both for the job seeker and the company hiring. Other job sites, like Monster.com and CareerBuilder, charge for posting ads. And that limits the number of jobs companies can afford to advertise, says Simon Evans, an executive with one of the Fortune 1000 companies backing the nonprofit site.
We don't post all our positions because, frankly, I can't afford to. So imagine what that means for a small business.
With no cost, he says more businesses will post more jobs. Already, 780,000 jobs are listed. Nathan Rott, NPR News, Washington.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Renee Montaigne. This is the time of year when students are wondering if they'll be accepted to the college of their choice. Many colleges and universities are asking themselves another question. How can we hold on to students once they're enrolled? Some schools see half their freshman class leave. NPR's Larry Abramson reports that some schools are trying to keep students coming back with a new twist on a familiar tool, social networking.
Last fall, these students were psyched to be starting school at Coppin State University in Baltimore, but if history is any guide, 40% of them will disappear before next year, victims of this school's low retention rate. To address this problem, some schools build physical spaces, new dorms with themes and clubs to make sure new students get involved. Those strategies can help, but the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation has been looking for new approaches. Today, the foundation is announcing it will invest $2 million in a company that's trying to build virtual college communities. Michael Staten is president of Integral, which builds school-based Facebook sites.
What we do is make sure that when students arrive, they either already have assembled or very quickly assemble that kind of peer support.
Peer support means a ready network of friends. Only students can gain entry to these sites, and they're invited in the moment they're accepted to a school. The feel is supposed to be small and intimate, unlike schools' fan sites on Facebook, which are open to everyone and don't inspire much networking. Columbia College, an arts and media school in Chicago, has been experimenting with a site. Samantha Sayazonza, a sophomore in journalism there, says it helps her merge her social and academic lives.
Actually check to see who's in my class and what their schedule's going to look like. That's really my favorite thing to do.
School clubs can use this technology to recruit and discuss campus issues. The sites are there for students, not for administrators. Schools pay what they say is a nominal fee for Integral to build a site. The hope is that they will get paid back through greater student engagement and higher retention rates. That saves them money in the long run because they don't have to replace all those dropouts. Carrie Barlow has been in charge of Arizona State's experiment with the Schools app.
Yeah, we have some indication that first-time freshmen who opted to participate in the application were highly more likely to be retained for the next semester.
It will be tough to show whether these efforts played any direct role in students' decision to stay or go. That's a subject for future research. And, of course, many students are out of reach of this and other approaches. Alexis Thompson, a sophomore who uses Columbia College's site, says it only works if kids work with it.
That's something that they have to be proactive about. So the Facebook app can be there, but unless you're being proactive and you want to go out and look for things like that, it's really on the student.
The Gates Foundation investment seems to show that the organization is casting a wide net to find new ideas that will improve outcomes in higher education. This is the first time that the nonprofit foundation has bought an actual equity stake in a for-profit company. Larry Abramson, NPR News, Washington.